It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Sort of a News Buzz edition, at least in our first half hour. News Buzz surrounding the coronavirus, a number of perspectives on the spreading virus, how we are adapting to it and preparing. Of course, the news yesterday that the World Health Organization declared the new coronavirus, COVID-19, the spread of it, officially a pandemic as of yesterday. Later in the hour, we'll have an interesting perspective on this. I'll be talking with Lawrence Wilkerson, a retired U.S. Army colonel, also notably former chief of staff to U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell. That was under George W. Bush. He'll give us his view, among other things, of the coronavirus and our reaction to it. But first, let's check in with IPR's health reporter, Natalie Krebs. Hi, Natalie.
Hello.
Focus in on Iowa with us, please. Tell us, what is the number of known coronavirus cases in Iowa?
So right now, Iowa has 14 known cases. 13 of those are in Johnson County, individuals between the ages of 61 and 80 years old. And those have actually all been tied to an Egyptian cruise. Those individuals look like they were all on one cruise in Egypt, where they contracted the virus. And then we have one in Pottawatomie County, which is an individual between the ages of 41 and 60. And the health department has said that individual traveled to California, where there's been some known cases, and that's where they're believed to have contracted it.
Right. For these individuals with who have been tested and positive, have given positive results to having COVID-19, where are they? How are they being treated in the state?
For most of them, I think 13 of the cases, people are at home in isolation. They're recovering. There's been one person in Johnson County who was admitted to the University of Iowa hospitals yesterday. I think they started out in critical condition, but health officials said yesterday afternoon during a press briefing that that person is doing better.
Mm-hmm. Right. And we want to emphasize, so far, nobody in Iowa has died from COVID-19. COVID-19, the disease caused by this strain of coronavirus. Let's talk about reaction to it. Changes in terms of organizations of all kinds, of all levels, but the public universities are reacting this week, right?
Yeah, that's probably been the biggest thing, is that Iowa's three public universities, University of Iowa, Iowa State University, and University of Northern Iowa, have all announced that they're going to transition to online classes later this month. So that affects March 23rd through at least April 3rd. Officials have said from the university that they are evaluating it kind of on a week-by-week basis, so it could possibly be longer than that. So right now they're just sort of preparing for that. They're working with faculty members to transition online. I know at universities, a lot of public events have been canceled as well.
Mm-hmm.
And as well as a number of smaller colleges, including Grinnell, Cornell, Drake University as well, are moving to online classes.
And so they're going online, closing their traditional classroom setups for a certain period of time, and will, after a certain period of time, reevaluate, I assume.
Yeah. So it's not, you know, we don't know for sure how long they'll be online. They're saying March 23rd through at least April 3rd. That could be longer. I think they've said as well that universities are not, they're not closing, like, dining halls, campus halls, residence halls will still be open.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just the classes that are going online.
Okay, definitely a different feeling this week than we had last week, Natalie. But it's always good in these conversations to go back to some of the basics that we as individuals need to remember during this time. Remind us of some of the simple everyday steps, the sort of new mindset we have to have when we leave our homes, even in our homes, and have contact with other people.
Right. Well, health officials are just saying that people need to continue to, you know, wash their hands, cover your mouth when you cough. And then I think the biggest thing is they want people to stay home when you're feeling sick, so not to spread any germs. And I know a number of companies, employers have had people stay at home, are starting to get people to work from home to sort of address that issue. And then as well as just if you have symptoms of fever or cough, just contact your health provider.
Mm-hmm. What is the latest word on the masks? I've heard different things about masks. See people wearing more masks, of course.
Yeah, I still think masks are not recommended by public health officials. I think that they're not necessary. And I think the risk in Iowa for coronavirus is still pretty low for people.
Of course, health providers you will see using it, and they have properly fitted masks. And in that environment, I think those masks are certainly needed and are effective, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's a little bit different for health providers. They use masks, but for the general public, I don't think it's recommended to go out and buy masks to be wearing in public.
Natalie Krebs, as you've been following this, what else do you have on your health radar, so to speak?
Right, and so some hospitals are actually limiting visitors as well. The Polk County Health Department has said it's limiting visitors in all Des Moines area hospitals. So visitors are going to be limited to primary caregivers, such as parents, guardians, spouses, partners. People need to be at least 16 years old. Unity Point Health has also announced that hospitals in Waterloo, Marshalltown, Grundy Center, and Sumner, they're also limiting patient visits to just two people who must be at least 18 years old. So in terms of, you know, if you have a loved one in the hospital, I would definitely check with them to see kind of what the new requirements are in terms of visitors. And then also the other thing is LifeServe Blood Center. It serves more than 100 hospitals in Iowa and neighboring states. They're concerned that the coronavirus is sort of their donations are declining. So they're really encouraging people to come out and, you know, give blood. They said it is a safe place to visit, and it's really necessary that they have that blood supply for patients who need it.
Okay, thank you very much, Natalie Krebs. And let me just throw in here, at the end here, you can have more information about the coronavirus from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention online at cdc.gov/coronavirus. Or here in Iowa, Natalie, I've heard you can call 211. That's the Iowa Department of Public Health's hotline. 211, dial that. It's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week if you have concerns or questions. Natalie, thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, all about the coronavirus outbreak, how it's impacting us in different ways. This week, Iowa's Attorney General Tom Miller warned Iowans to be on the lookout for price gouging and other scams related to the COVID-19 virus. Iowa's Attorney General Tom Miller joins us now. Welcome to the program, Attorney General.
Nice to be on the program. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into price gouging and other scams, this is a warning you issued because it was triggered by Governor Kim Reynolds' declaration of a state of disaster emergency, right?
That's exactly right. When Governor Reynolds issued the disaster emergency order, that automatically triggered the price gouging regulations that are part of our office and part of our authority. We did not have to do anything. It automatically triggered it, which is a good concept. It gets it done right away, and there's no doubt about it.
Right. Unfortunately, in times of emergency, there are people who will take advantage of the situation. That's what price gouging is about. But in this case, it also has a legal definition. In this context, during an emergency, what is price gouging?
Price gouging in a setting like this, an emergency setting, is to for the price to be significantly higher than it was just previously to the emergency. There is some flexibility. The cost of people's products can rise somewhat, and that's allowed under the regulation. But that's at the margin. Any kind of dramatic increase relative to the previous price is price gouging.
Mm-hmm. And whether it's in a brick and mortar store or whether it's online, it doesn't matter. It's whatever the consumer can buy, wherever that may be.
Yeah, it tracks the consumer purchases, not where they purchase it.
Have there been, or can you point to any instances of price gouging already during this coronavirus outbreak?
There's been some situations on Amazon. We've had a complaint concerning dental mesh. There's also been, I think, a complaint concerning a sanitizer. And Amazon has spoken out and said they're going to deal with these kinds of situations. So those are the two that we've seen thus far.
Mm-hmm. And when you get a complaint, like the ones you just mentioned, dental mesh, and for instance, on Amazon. Does that get tracked by your office over time to see if Amazon is actually doing what it said it would?
What we do is try and immediately contact the merchant or whoever is the seller, whoever is responsible for the price gouging, and you know, point out the rule, ask them for their explanation, and you know, do a little jawboning to try and make sure that this is stopped if it was, and then of course we do keep an eye on what they do in the future.
Mm-hmm. What is the penalty for a retailer who is found guilty or of price gouging?
I think essentially it's a violation of the Consumer Fraud Act, and we have the remedies there, including restitution.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how best can individuals who think they've encountered price gouging contact your office with a complaint?
Well, you know, one way is to phone us, and in the Des Moines area, the phone number is 515-281-5926. And then outside the Des Moines area, it's a toll-free number, 888-777-4590. And they can also email us at consumer@ag.iowa.gov.
Okay. Your office, the Attorney General's Office of Iowa, also is telling us to be wary of other types of scams, preying on the fear over the coronavirus in other ways. What should we also be on the lookout for?
Well, probably the other number one concern would be bogus treatments, that claims that there are treatments or vaccines or preventative kinds of measures, and there aren't any at this point. So sometimes they're teas, sometimes they're essential oils, sometimes it's silver. And those are all bogus kinds of claims that people should stay away from.
Right. And in our news, we've heard that a vaccine is, when it gets through all the tests, it's a year away, perhaps longer than that. And if you're saying if you hear of a treatment that is claiming to cure or protect you from COVID-19, that is bogus. And that should be reported as well to your office.
Definitely, and as quickly as possible. We want to deal with that as quickly as we can.
Mm-hmm. Phishing scams we encounter in just normal everyday life, unfortunately. Do we have an uptick in those during these times of emergencies?
We tend to. I mean, the people that are involved in fraud are pretty clever, and they understand the context and the times that we're in, and what is topical, what can they take advantage of, and those that are in the phishing scams, you know, recognize this, and they claim to be from the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They claim to be from the World Health Organizations or other experts, and are trying to get your information, trying to give you information.
Right, either calls, or this can be an email or a text. It's telling you, it's trying to direct you to a certain link or a website, and then in order to get information from you. How can you tell that it's not the CDC? I suppose the WHO or the CDC is just not calling people like that, are they?
They aren't. I mean, it's like Social Security and the utilities. They're not contacting people by phone. They're not contacting people directly. What people should do if they want information, and obviously there's a great need for information right now, is to go to the websites for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and for the World Health Organization and other organizations that are really well known.
Mm-hmm. Charity scams. Explain that. Your office put out a warning about that in these emergency times.
Yeah, I mean, there'll be charities that pop up to aid the victims of the coronavirus, be careful of that. Be careful of sort of look-alike charities. They make it sound like the legitimate charities. People should go to Better Business Bureau, Wise Giving Alliance, to Charity Navigator, to Charity Watch, or GuideStar to sort of verify before they send any of their hard-earned money by check or by transfer.
And the last category that your office is warning of is investment fraud. What form would that take?
Well, They'll claim that there are companies that deal with these kinds of issues, deals with cures or deal with some of the products, and claim that there's, you know, that they have this business and they have great success and to invest in their company, and that's investment fraud.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much, Iowa's Attorney General Tom Miller. And again, to contact for more information, you can go online to find the Iowa Attorney General's office and your complaints at your Consumer Protection Division. Correct, Tom Miller?
That's exactly correct. We encourage people to contact us.
Tom Miller, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're getting a number of perspectives on the spreading coronavirus, how we are adapting to it, how we are preparing for it, how it's changing our lives now and is likely to do in the coming weeks, who knows, months. Well, communities of faith all around the country and the state are having to plan and adjust because of the COVID-19 outbreak. Let's check in with one of Iowa's faith communities by talking with Rabbi David Kaufman of the Temple B'nai Jeshurun in Des Moines. Rabbi Kaufman, welcome to the program.
Hey, Ben, it's great to be on.
Okay. David, what's it been like today so far and yesterday with the declaration, especially of the WHO, that this is a pandemic? And it's really feeling different this week, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, practically every day. I mean, things are changing day by day. We've kind of anticipated that things were going to get worse with COVID, but you know, we're also dealing with just the flu season too. So, this time of year, we're already kind of in a posture of everybody wash your hands, and if you're sick, don't come, and things like that. That's kind of traditional at this time of year, because people who come to religious services tend to be, you know, older people, and oftentimes people who are in need of spiritual support are people who have underlying health conditions that they want the spiritual support for.
Mm.
So you're pretty much always thinking about health this time of year, and you know, with the COVID stuff, it just amplifies it much, much more. I mean, now the people, you know, those people who are in spiritual need are really being told not to come to large gatherings, and so we're having to adapt to figure out ways to kind of provide ongoing support.
So what solutions have you found?
Well, so we're looking at different online streaming solutions. We've done some of that for some of our services in the past, but now, you know, we're looking at things like streaming online classes and you know, interactive video type things online, and you're going to end up having, you know, a lot of phone calls instead of in-person meetings, and potentially, you know, potentially smaller group meetings. Those can probably still continue, but it's going to require some changes here for the next few months. Certainly, the next month or so.
So it sounds like you're planning for the worst. We're all hoping it won't be that bad. So, in your mind, from what the information you're getting, what is the worst case scenario?
I mean, so one of the things that's going on is that the recommendation is to take more radical action than you think is reasonable right now. So that's the biggest problem, is if you're trying to flatten the curve, you need to get ahead of it, and mm-hmm. that means, you know, trying to help limit the spread of this means taking precautions that don't seem necessary right now, and so a lot of places are starting to act proactively. Rather than waiting for cases to hit their community, because once they hit the community, you're already in trouble.
Right.
So we're having to look at that. We're really discouraging people who are ill from coming to things. You know, if right. you're coughing or sneezing, for sure, don't bring it to everybody else.
Let me ask you about worship at your temple. I'm not familiar with worship in the Jewish tradition. I wonder how much close interaction is there, touching, the social distance. Are you making changes there?
Well, we'll have to. I mean, you know, I think that traditionally people are sitting in pews or sitting in chairs relatively close together. And they're singing and chanting, and you know they're around one another. And Jews do a lot of hugging and handshaking and sharing of food and all kinds of other stuff. You know, that's traditional in religious congregational environments. And so now we're having to think, you know, if we're gonna do services, are we gonna do them in more open spaces? If we have a small enough crowd, can we do them in this space as opposed to another space? And then there are suggestions that crowds over certain numbers, you know, you shouldn't have, and that affects. We don't have too many times where we get really large crowds over the course of the year. But sometimes you have family life cycle events that might, and we have Passover coming up, so there are times when you could have large groups, and you have to figure out, you know, what the requirements are. And to be honest, this stuff's changing day by day because the recommendations from the government are changing day by day.
Right. Yeah.
So some communities have had their health departments come out and say no gatherings over 50 people. And that kind of changes the dynamic. It's no longer, you know, it's no longer up to you what you want to do. You're either going to take the recommendation or not.
Okay. Well, you've given us a picture of what you're facing, things very much in flux as they are for many organizations. We wish you well. Hey, David, I saw on your website a wine and cheese social for Friday evening. Is that still on?
Well, we'll still have the wine part. I'm not so sure about the other part. So food is a little more problematic than wine because people can pour a drink. That's different. But and with all this stuff going on, people may well need wine. I think the wine producers are going to do pretty well.
Okay. Rabbi David Kaufman of the Temple B'nai Jeshurun in Des Moines, thanks for giving us the picture from your faith community there. We wish you well in coping with it.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Coming up after a short break, my guest in the next half hour, Lawrence Wilkerson. Wilkerson is a retired U.S. Army colonel and most notably former chief of staff to the U.S. Secretary of State, Colin Powell. That live discussion coming up. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest for this half hour is Larry Wilkerson. Wilkerson is a retired U.S. Army colonel and most notably in his decades of military and public service, former chief of staff to U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell under George W. Bush. That was in the early 2000s, 2001 to 2005. Colonel Wilkerson joins us this half hour. Thank you for joining our program, sir.
Good to be with you.
We both, within the last few minutes, received notice that the event that you were due to come to speak in Iowa for has been canceled. That was at the annual Iowa State Building and Construction Trades Council convention next Wednesday. You can confirm that. That has been canceled. You got the word as well, I understand.
I did, and the leadership and I had a conversation. We were both willing to go ahead, but I guess cooler heads prevailed, if you will, and
right. So
it got canceled.
All due to the coronavirus, so much turned topsy-turvy, our markets, our meetings, our churches. We talked about that last half hour. You weren't with us then. But let's jump right into the coronavirus crisis here. Let's draw on your vast experience, your long record of military and public service, working here in the U.S., but also with governments around the world, as I mentioned, most notably under former Secretary of State Colin Powell. What are your thoughts on this public health crisis, this world pandemic?
I learned a great deal about epidemics, if you will, and the potential they had for destruction across the globe right after 9/11, when I was briefed by some of the very best people from Johns Hopkins University and elsewhere, who had made lifelong studies of these sorts of things. And, of course, at that time, we were concerned about terrorists getting a handle on some of this. My knowledge now would say I think we've done a couple of things that were very, very poorly done. One is we waited so long to begin extensive testing so that now we probably have 5 or 10 or perhaps even more than we're saying cases in the United States. People just don't know, young people in particular, just don't know that they have the virus. And second, now that we're past really a chance for a successful preventive phase, we're into a mitigation phase that includes things we should have done in the prevention phase, like prohibit traffic from overseas and so forth. That's nonsense now because it's already here, and it's already multiplying at what I'm told will be an astronomical fast rate. So I'm not happy at all with the way the government has handled this to this point.
Right. And when you the WHO yesterday lauded China and South Korea for their treatment of it. In China's case, they're down to, in terms of new cases per day, the low double digits, if not the single digits. Incredible when you think of that population there. But of course, they have an authoritarian government. In our open society, Colonel Wilkerson, that sort of you have the virus, you will not go back to your family, this is where you'll be quarantined treatment does not work, does it?
That's true. First thing I'd say, though, to what you just said, I hope it's true, but I've been working with China since about 1984, and I've learned that the truth often gets changed in China. So I hope that's a correct appraisal of the situation there.
All right.
But I'm not at all confident it is. Secondly, I wouldn't trade our openness for their authoritarianism.
I wasn't suggesting that. I was just in this narrow sense, right?
No, I understand. The same kind of phenomena I observed in Cuba when we were talking about hurricane preparation and hurricane defense. They do a magnificent job because when they tell people to get out of their homes and move to a center or whatever, people move. In this country,
right,
you have to beg people to do that. So it is a shortcoming, if you will, of our society. But as I said, and I wasn't implying you thought differently, I wouldn't trade it for the freedom we enjoy.
No, of course not. I wonder, from this point, you said missteps up to this point. Now we're in the thick of it. The sense is we're at the thin end of the wedge here going forward. We don't know what's coming at us. What confidence do you have that the U.S. can, at this point on, under this leadership, effectively move to stem this?
I'm hoping that the subsidiary leadership, if you will, that is in the states and counties and parishes and so forth, it'll be dealt with properly. Given that they've gotten a bad start with regard to the national leadership, I still think that's where our strength is. That's where we'll do the defensive actions, preventive actions, and so forth that are important. I hope, though, that we don't, and I'm reinforced in this by some of the epidemiologists and others with whom I've been talking, I hope we don't let this virus cause such economic and other fundamental damage to this country that we have a really hard time not only getting through the period that the virus suggests we might have to go through, but also do irreparable or serious damage, at least, to our economy. That's part of the problem, I think, that was created by the failure to deal with this smartly from the beginning. So my concern right now, though I have a deep concern, I'm 75 years old, I have a deep concern for people. My family was just in France and fortunately were able to get out quickly because Air France was able to give them a flight out, incidentally a flight that was virtually empty. But I have great empathy and sympathy for people like me and others who are vulnerable to this virus. But at the same time, I don't want to see the country's economy virtually set back a year or two or perhaps more by the kind of fears that this virus creates that I think are probably unjustified.
If you've just joined us, my guest this half hour, a live conversation with Colonel Larry Wilkerson, a long military career, most notably former chief of staff to the U.S. Secretary of State, the former U.S. Secretary of State, Colin Powell, in the early 2000s. Well, let's move on from Corona, unless you had some other things to add, Colonel. I would like to ask you about other foreign policy threats. What do you consider the most serious foreign policy threats to the U.S. at this time?
I think right now that the reality of what, for example, John Mearsheimer from the University of Chicago has pointed out with regard to U.S.-China relationships is probably the number one concern I have. As I said, I've been involved with Northeast Asia and China in particular for a long time, 40-plus years. I'm very concerned with what I see right now developing. If you listen to Secretary of Defense Mark Esper, for example, a couple of weeks ago, he essentially pronounced a Cold War with China. I'm very concerned about that. It doesn't have to be that way. We might just be making it a self-fulfilling prophecy that we ultimately have to go to war with China. I don't think anyone is a winner in that, certainly not the U.S. or China, and certainly not the region or perhaps even the world. So that's my, outside of the existential threat looming large down the road, the climate crisis, and nuclear weapons, that's my major regional foreign and security policy concern is the U.S. relationship with China.
Mm-hmm. I wondered if you'd comment on the news this week from Moscow, where a constitutional change is allowing Vladimir Putin to run for president again in 2024, really sailed through Russia's lower house of parliament. It opens the potential for him to stay in power incredibly till 2036. This is two successive six-year terms added on starting at 2024. Putin is 67. Of course, he's dominated the Russian political landscape already for two decades, either as president or prime minister. With Putin at the helm of Russia, probably into the 2030s, what are the implications there for U.S. foreign policy, in your view?
I would recommend to every one of your listeners, and to you, of course, also, that you view Alex Gibney's new documentary called Citizen K.
Alex Gibney was on this program, as a matter of fact.
Well, it's more, in my view, an expose of Vladimir Putin than it is Mikhail Khodorkovsky, Citizen K.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember that movie, there's a scene in there where I think he's wandering through St. Catherine's Palace, and he's all alone.
Yes.
And there's red carpet everywhere, and he's well-dressed, and he's looking at pictures of Peter the Great on the wall and everything. And then the narrator sort of says something like, Putin must always be thinking, I'm just a second away from my downfall. I think that's true.
Yeah.
I don't think the Russian people are going to tolerate him for that long a period, and I think he's probably going to wind up having to dismount the tiger, as it were, and then the tiger's going to eat him.
Right, and it is an incredible film, Citizen K, showing how Vladimir Putin rose from a low-level bureaucrat, really like a passport stamper type of bureaucrat, to where he mm-hmm. was. An incredible player on the world geopolitical stage, though, right? In terms of playing the power that Russia has.
Yes, he's been playing from a very, very limited deck of cards, and yet he's been beating, for example, us all over the map, from Ukraine, Crimea, to Syria, to Libya. He's been, largely because of our strategic errors, most notable of which was the invasion of Iraq in 2003, my administration's grievous bad decision. But he's been playing a game well above his capacity, militarily or otherwise, economically, financially. And in that sense, he's sort of a chess master, but he's a chess master that I would like to see go away.
Mm-hmm. While you're there, because our listeners perhaps aren't aware of it, you have owned some of the errors as you saw them in the working in the administration to get into the Iraq War. You've criticized some of the aspects, including some of your work for Colin Powell. I wonder if you would remind us of that.
Well, the most notable event, ignoble event, I would call it, both personally and professionally, was our presentation to the UN Security Council on 5 February 2003, where we essentially asserted for an hour and 20-some-odd minutes that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, which, of course, was proven once we had invaded the country to be absolutely false. I participated in that, and I'll go to my grave with that knowledge and with the knowledge of the dead Americans and dead tens of thousands of Iraqis on my head. It was a catastrophic decision. What we're seeing in the Middle East today is a result of that decision. Everything from the birth of ISIS to the war in Syria to the unrest in Iran now, all as a result of that bad decision by us in 2002 and 2003.
Mm-hmm. Now back to Putin. It's clear Putin's aim is to influence and destabilize democracies in Europe, also, of course, ours. He's been at it using the devices on the internet. What do you see there in the future? How successful, now that we're, at least officially, all of our intelligence agencies chime in, yes, it happened then and it's happening now. What is your confidence that we will effectively fend off this meddling in our election this time around?
I think Putin actually decisively influenced the Brexit vote in the United Kingdom. I think you can lay the United Kingdom's departure from Europe, the EU, at Putin's feet in many respects, if not all respects. I think Putin has two strategic goals with regard to Moscow's West, if you will. One is the dissolution of the European Union, and that is proceeding apace. And two is the breakup of NATO. And I would say with the help of Donald Trump, who seems to abominate NATO most of the time, that's proceeding apace also. I think he's going to try and probably will succeed to some extent to interfere in the elections here in this country in 2020. In fact, I belong to a group that is looking at that very, very seriously in conjunction with the intelligence community and others. And I think the potential for Putin to walk into the holes, if you will, in our election process. We have states that have absolutely no paper backup in many of their computerized voting precincts. So there's no backup at all. And hacking those computer systems would be the work of a fairly competent high schooler. So we are looking at the potential for a great deal of crisis in this election, much of it produced by Moscow, the GRU, KGB, FSB intelligence complex, and at the behest of Vladimir Putin.
Mm-hmm. We have just a few more minutes in a live conversation with Colonel Larry Wilkerson, former chief of staff to former U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell. What are your thoughts then on Donald Trump's relationship to Putin? Of course, it's hard to find any instances where he really criticizes Putin. In fact, quite the opposite.
I wish I knew more, or maybe I wish I didn't. I can't deny the correlation between many of Trump's more substantive actions with regard to everything from nuclear weapons to the Baltic states, to NATO, to hotel building around the world, and Putin's wishes or Putin's designs. It's eerie how much correlation there is, and the place that concerns me the most is nuclear weapons. We should not be building new nuclear weapons. We should not have $1 trillion+ allocated to that purpose over the next decade. We should be having new arms control talks, new strategic and tactical arms control talks, and we should be multilateralizing the existing treaties that are still here anyway. We need to bring other countries in, like North Korea, like Israel, like Pakistan, like India, and so forth. We need to have arms control. We are letting the nuclear genie get out of the bottle again.
Of course, Donald Trump campaigned on a promise to improve relations with Russia. He makes the case that that's a very good thing. Do you share that view?
I do. I think just for what I said, the nuclear weapons issue, we need better relations. You know, we talked to the Russians throughout the Soviet period. we had strategic arms talks and we had treaties that worked. Come to my administration when we're dealing with Russia, and we started helping them destroy their nuclear warheads. It was a heady period. We were doing something that really benefited the entire globe, including America. Now we're building again. Now we're treating them as if they were possessed of a battlefield utility. That's one of the most dangerous things you can do. Russia already has published doctrine to that extent, and we've had statements made by undersecretaries and the Secretary of Defense saying that we're going to counter tit for tat. So we're back in a period like we were in 1951 and 52, where we actually think nuclear weapons have a utility on the battlefield. That's preposterous and very dangerous.
So what is the way out of that?
Nuclear arms control talks again. We, as I said, we need to sit down with Russia first, and we need to craft out a policy to deal with the two biggest nuclear arms owners in the world, Russia and us. And then we need to figure out a way to bring others in. As I said, Israel, Pakistan, India. Pakistan's nuclear stockpile right now is probably the most potentially dangerous in the world to a terrorist acquiring a weapon or to just some loss of nuclear material. And yet Pakistan is not under anybody's arms control agreement, is not a party to any of them. It probably, in its relationship with India, is the most likely place for a state-to-state nuclear confrontation to start. So all of this needs to be taken into consideration and dealt with diplomatically.
We talk about many issues having to do with the 2020 election in November on this program, Colonel. What you just mentioned is really not on the not only not on the top of the list, but maybe not even on the list.
That's a grave problem.
Yeah. Yeah. will this election, based on what you know, where we are in this primary process and the president we have right now, does a lot hinge on the 2020 election? What hinges on the 2020 election, in your view?
I think the future of this country hinges on the 2020 election, and maybe even existentially so. We have one party that, for example, my party, I'm a Republican, that denies climate change even exists. When I was in Iowa earlier, I met with your Farm Bureau, probably the most powerful Farm Bureau in the United States. Most of them, I think, from their conversation with me, were Republicans, and they recognize the climate crisis. They recognize that they're having higher yields and longer growing seasons and more water and so forth and so on. So the fact that we have a White House that doesn't even recognize perhaps the greatest danger to the human race is just nonsense. We need to have someone in the White House who understands, at least rudimentary, wise, the climate crisis and begins to take decisive action to deal with it. We've got to do that. And then the nuclear weapons problem I was talking about doesn't seem to be being dealt with by this White House. These are issues that are serious, and they're in our face, and they need to be dealt with. And they take leadership, good leadership.
We have about a minute left, Colonel Wilkerson. Comment on that when we talk about climate change. Why the Republican Party or more figures in the Republican Party don't speak the language of science on this? Why do they evade questions on climate science?
Well, while I'll admit some of them, and I've met with almost all of them, are just plain stupid, I'll say that it's not the case most of the time. Most of the time, it has to do with all manner of complex issues, such as they are bought and paid for by the fossil fuel industry, like Jim Inhofe in Oklahoma. Or, on the other hand, they're bought and paid for by the coal industry and other aspects of recognizing climate change that they think would be hurt by that. It's time to get beyond that. It's time to recognize that the market itself is moving away from fossil fuels, certainly moving away from coal. It was remarkable to me to find out that Iowa only had one coal-fired plant left,
right?
That it was 51, 52% wind and solar already. So I mean, that's the kind of state leadership, state governance that needs to be taking place. But we need some general guidance from Washington too.
Colonel Wilkerson,
we have run out of time. People are denying. Yeah.
Colonel Wilkerson, thanks, I wish we could speak all afternoon. I hope we meet, and I hope you have a chance to come back to Iowa. Sorry that your event was canceled next week. I'm sure a lot of people would have enjoyed meeting you.
I love Iowa. I'd love to come back.
All right. Colonel Larry Wilkerson, former chief of staff to the former U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.